you give them a little bit, they're going to give you a whole lot more. They're going to be better at pollination services on your farm. They're going to provide pest control in a variety of different ways, especially if you have a diversified habitat. And so they're going to do a lot of work for you.
Welcome to the 372nd installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. A couple of decades ago, I had the opportunity to contribute to a book called The Farm as Natural Habitat, Reconnecting Food Systems with Ecosystems. Co-edited by the mother-daughter team of Dana and Laura Jackson, this collection of essays is based on an important premise. Natural ecosystems and working farms can be blended in a manner that's mutually beneficial. A farm that rotationally grazes livestock in a way that supports a diverse mosaic of perennial forages on the land, for example, can provide habitat for grassland songbirds like bobolinks. And those birds, in turn, help keep insect pests in check. By the way, those birds can also be key indicators as to the health of those grasses and forbs, helping farmers gauge whether they are on the right track when it comes to managing the landscape for optimal production. It's truly a win-win. That idea runs counter to the philosophy upon which our conventional, industrialized system of agriculture is constructed. That system is based on the idea that natural ecosystems and productive agriculture are pretty much mutually exclusive. More often than not, insects, birds, mammals, and other wild residents are seen as a threat to farming and are removed from the landscape utilizing chemicals, tillage, and other tools of the trade. That's too bad. As entomologist and agroecologist Jonathan Lundgren points out, for every species of pest, there are 1,700 species of insects we can't live without. Some of the ideas around the benefits of working with nature that were discussed in The Farm as Natural Habitat remind me of conversations I've been having in recent years with farmers who are building healthy, resilient soil with the help of microbes, bugs, and biology. That makes sense. The soil biome is one of the most diverse habitats on the planet. When The Farm as Natural Habitat was published, Dana Jackson was LSP's associate director. During that time, she joined up with a group of wildlands proponents and ecological farming advocates to help launch the Wild Farm Alliance. This organization's basic mission is to promote a healthy, viable agriculture that helps to protect and restore wild nature. During the past quarter century, Executive Director Joanne Baumgartner and her small staff have been working with farmers and ecologists to establish habitat on farms that, as they put it, supports a dance between the wild and the domestic. For most of its history, the Wild Farm Alliance has worked with farmers and ranchers out west. So I was thrilled to recently attend a field day sponsored by the group on Key Wayden Farms in southwestern Wisconsin. By the way, you can listen to an interview I did with Key Wayden farmer Joy Miller on Ear to the Ground episode 371. This field day represented a relatively new direction the Wild Farm Alliance is taking by expanding its presence in the Midwest. I recently had an opportunity to talk to Shelley Connor, the Wild Farm Alliance's deputy director, and Courtney Cheetah, who is a program associate for the organization. Both are based in Minnesota. We talked about the Alliance's various programs as well as the latest research showing how working farmland and natural ecosystems can work hand in hand. Shelley started our conversation by providing some background on the Wild Farm Alliance and its overall goals.
The Wild Farm Alliance is a national organization with a mission to promote healthy, viable agriculture that protects and restores wild nature. It was started about 25 years ago when a group of wildlands proponents and sustainable ag proponents got together and decided, you know, we don't have to be adversaries. We can actually work together. We're looking at these same goals. And, you know, just as you said, farming and the wild don't have to be pitted against one another. They can help one another. So they got together and decided to form this organization. In 2020, we The board and the staff of Wild Farm Alliance got together to create this 2050 vision, where we really wanted to set the stage and set our goals and let the world know where we wanted to be and where we thought we needed to be to make really positive change. And that 2050 vision has these three main farmland goals. So the three goals of our 2050 vision are the farmland flyaways, where we want to see 10% of U.S. farms join a farmland flyaway trail. And that means having an average of 5 nest boxes or perches on their land, which would lead to 1 million structures across the country. And then our farmland wildways goal is to inspire 25% of U.S. farms to plant a farmland wildway, having an average of 1 mile of a hedgerow, a windbreak, or pollinator planting that would lead to 500,000 miles of living field borders. And then our farmland waterways goal is to inspire 10% of river frontage on farms to be planted as a waterway, which would lead to 100,000 miles of riverine habitat. And so those are the goals that we're working towards as an organization and how we frame our work when we work with growers, whether it's in California or here in Minnesota and Wisconsin. We really aim to work towards those goals, and that's how we talk about our work.
What would you consider? There is no typical farmer, of course, but what would be a typical farmer that might be drawn to the Wild Farm Alliance and working with you? What kind of things are they looking at?
Yeah, we work with all sorts of farmers on the West Coast and in the Midwest. Lots of vineyards and small to medium-sized vegetable and specialty crop growers. Some large almond and pistachio orchards out in California. And the common thread among all of those are these diverse growers with their desire to incorporate biodiversity into their operations in order to build healthy, resilient farms. And here in the Midwest, we're working with livestock, fruit and vegetable growers. I have been largely involved with sort of the organic farming movement for a long time. And so the sustainable ag community is definitely, they're typically already somewhat engaged and interested in the kind of work that we're doing in. But we're interested in anybody working with anybody who wants to make change on the landscape.
When I think about the Wild Farm Alliance and some of these stories I see on your website of some of the farmers that you're working with, it seems like to me the ultimate goal, don't let me put words in your mouth, but this is the way I'm viewing it, is if you can find examples where a farmer is able to have the ultimate win-win, you know, win-win is used way too much, but I think it is fitting in this case, a win-win where you have a farming practice that's profitable, it's viable, it's productive, but also it's good for the ecosystem and it's good for wildlife and that kind of thing. Do you have some examples that you can pull up of where you have seen those win-wins?
Yeah, so we know that biodiversity and economic interests are really not adversaries, right? They mutually enhance the profitability. When farmers, for example, support beneficial birds by putting in native habitat or a nest box or a structure, they're not only seeing, you know, that the birds are coming and they're, you know, occupying those nest boxes, but they're seeing less pests. They're having to use less chemicals because the birds are doing their job. They're eating those bugs and those caterpillars that are potentially damaging their crops. And then that native habitat that they're putting in is, you know, holding the soil in place. They have less erosion issues. And so those are the examples that we see all the time when we're talking with farmers. When we work with farmers, the nest boxes tend to be sort of the gateway, right, to conservation, because they get occupied right away, most likely. And when the farmer just sees the birds already occupying, feeding their babies their insects, they see them go in and out hundreds of times over the breeding season, they see that it works. And so it's much easier then to have a conversation about, okay, here's something else you can do in addition to this nest box or this structure that you put up, because they see the results of that right away. And then the other thing I wanted to say is that, you know, supporting beneficial birds is not this new radical idea at all. In fact, lots of cultures and indigenous land stewards have been, utilizing these practices for many, many years. And even the USDA, like 140 years ago, was touting the economic benefits of birds. They had a whole division of economic ornithology.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
It is. And so they were basically focused on studying these positive effects of birds in controlling agricultural pests. And then eventually this morphed into becoming the wildlife part of the Department of U.S. Fish and Wildlife. And so while, over the course of many years, the focus kind of strayed away from birds and to more of a broader wildlife, in the last 20 years, there's really been a resurgence of interest and research specifically on how birds are really beneficial. And I think that's because birds are, really charismatic. And like I said, the results when they come onto the farm are immediate. And when you put up a nest box, it's just, really lovely. And farmers are naturally akin to the nature and the landscape around their farm. And so when they can see that they're helping nature be a part of their farm and that nature is also being a part of their operation and they're part of the workforce, I think it's a really beautiful synergy.
I like this idea of the gateway, the next spot, I can speak from experience because a couple weeks ago Wild Farm Alliance hosted that field day at Kuwaiten Farms, and we did a birding hike and had nest boxes set up along the trail. And boy, did people get excited when they saw a bluebird come out of one of those nest boxes. It was such a neat thing. It's like a physical thing people can glom onto. The other thing is, you were talking about birds can be, in a way, a species that you notice and can make connections. And back in the 90s, Land Stewardship Project did a project called a monitoring project where we were working with 6 farmers who were doing managed rotational grazing, and they were looking for indicators of success. And there were several indicators that we practiced on and utilized. Birds were the number one. They were really popular. Farmers really learned how to be bird nerds, and they learned to make that connection between, for example, and this is something we talked about at that field day you had a couple weeks ago with the Audubon Society, talking about healthier grasslands creates healthier grassland habitat for birds and in turn better forage for the livestock. And then the other example was Kuwaiten Farms. They're seeing less pest pressure both in their vegetable operation and on their sheep operation because of the birds. So that, I just find that super exciting when farmers can start seeing those connections. But the other thing I wanted to, that you kind of alluded to, was this whole movement reminds me a little bit of the soil health movement, in that people may have noticed some things in the past, but they didn't quite know what they meant. But now the science is starting to catch up to it. Is that kind of what you folks are seeing? Is the science kind of, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so back in 2018, we looked at 120 different research studies. We're looking at how birds interacted with agriculture, and of those 120 studies, 90% showed that birds were actually beneficial in some way in terms of reducing pests. And then there are lots of really cool specific examples beyond that, too. My favorite is probably a Cornell study that looked at hummingbirds reducing the spotted-winged Drosophila fly infestations in berry patches. And they found that in their studies, like 64% of the insects were reduced, and that hummingbirds can eat up to 2,000 insects per day.
Hummingbirds eat insects?
Yeah. And that having those like nectar feeders in the raspberry patch could reduce, 81% of those flights to those feeders, they could eat insects at the same time. So like, plus, there's the added benefit of, like, having, hummingbirds in your raspberry patch, and the, like, agritourism benefit of that for a UPIC farm is huge. Like, it's a triple win, right? Like, on all accounts. There's also really cool studies from Michigan looking at their cherry-growing region, and the researchers studied the effects of putting up American kestrel boxes, where they're actually deterring the pest birds in those orchards. And that they were only feeding on, 2% of the birds as part of their diet, but they've discouraged the pest birds in the orchard altogether. For every dollar spent on nest boxes, up to $357 of sweet cherries were saved from pest birds. So like a huge, you know, reduction in damage across the state that resulted in more than $2 million over 5 years. Lots of other great examples of having field edge near kale that attracted lots of birds that were eating lots of cabbage looper caterpillars, and, you know, compared to fields that didn't have that habitat nearby. Also in like apple orchards and walnut orchards, reducing the codling moths when you had that natural habitat nearby, the chickadees would come in and clear those out for the farms.
Wow.
And then in Europe, the researchers were putting up nest boxes to support the blue and great tits, and the apple yields were increasing by 66%, and they found a reduction of the pest insects too. So tons of research out there that shows that birds can really be beneficial.
I think that's really exciting, and it must help maybe get over some of the barriers to making these connections on a consistent basis in agriculture. And I was wondering if you could talk about what are the major barriers, either policy-wise, ecologically, even kind of sociologically, that we run into as far as making, you know, when you hear these stories, you're like, oh, well, of course, why wouldn't you have beneficial birds on your farm and try to create habitat to support them? But there's reasons why we don't have those.
Yeah, so of course there are always a few birds that give all birds a bad name that can be problematic for farmers, you know, either eating seedlings or eating fruit or causing damage in some way to the crop. We definitely don't shy away from talking about that because that is a real issue for farmers to deal with and face. But as Courtney said, you know, a majority of birds at some point in their lifetime are actually beneficial because they're feeding their young insects.
Mm-hmm.
That is the main diet. And so we really like to talk about helping to promote the birds that might be pests when they are beneficial, you know, supporting them, and then working on strategies to deter them when they do and could often become pests. So using different strategies like the mylar ribbon or other fencing or netting when needed. Yeah, we talk to farmers about those issues that they might face. So that is one. So, you know, some birds just give all birds a bad name, and that is, you know, not true.
So which is the bird that gets the nastiest reputation?
Well, I think that, let me see. I think there are a lot of songbirds that, you know, like when you're attracting bluebirds, folks are worried that they're actually eating fruit, and bluebirds are not going to damage the fruit necessarily. I mean, there's probably a story about them doing that, but I know there were some vineyards that were worried about that, and I'm not saying that it never happens, but most likely that is not the case.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, red-winged blackbirds often get a pretty bad name, which, you know, they can be really problematic. But in the spring and early summer, they're actually really helpful by picking out pests in cornfields and feeding them to their young. And so they are really, really helpful in certain parts of the time. And then, yes, they do become pests later on in the season, especially in corn, they can. And that's when you have to work on strategies to keep them out mm-hmm. and to deter them using different strategies. And then there's also sort of this myth of, like, you know, to be profitable, you have to grow fence row to fence row, and all your land has to be put into production. We really try to work with growers to identify areas, whether they're on fence lines or, you know, just giving a little bit of space to the wild and to birds, or even, you know, putting in that habitat that's not going to just attract birds, but also is going to attract natural enemies and insects, beneficial insects and pollinators. Just flipping the script a little bit of saying, you know, if you give them a little bit, they're going to give you a whole lot more. They're going to be better at pollination services on your farm. They're going to provide pest control in a variety of different ways, especially if you have a diversified habitat. You're going to not just be attracting one type of bird, but you're going to be attracting a whole set of birds and a whole set of insects that are all going to do pest control in their own unique way. And they're going to be attacking, you know, all of those pest insects that you have from lots of different angles. And so they're going to do a lot a lot of work for you. And then again, that habitat is going to provide cover on your land. So you're going to be better at holding water in your soil, and you're going to have less erosion, and you're just going to have a healthier ecosystem that is going to provide a better place for your plants to grow too. Yeah. Healthier plants, which will need less of your inputs.
Is there farm policy is the big one that controls, as they say, what our landscape looks like, particularly here in the Midwest in corn soybean country. Are there some policy barriers that get in the way of kind of making these connections and supporting wildlife?
The Farm Bill has several programs like EQIP, the Environmental Quality Incentive Program, and the Conservation Stewardship Program that do provide funding to put in place some of these practices that we talk about. However, it's really competitive and it's really hard to get that funding sometimes, especially right now in lieu of where we're at. And so when the government isn't, you know, working and handing out that money, it does put the farmers in a hard place, right? Because it costs money to do some of this implementation. But then that's where we go back to really trying to start with something simple like a nest box. Mm-hmm. Doesn't cost a lot of money, and it does lead to being able to think about your farm in a little bit of a different way of how you can provide habitat to then in turn, you know, get all of those benefits from the wildlife that you're supporting. So I would say if in terms of policy barriers, you know, right now it's just the lockup of the federal funding is really problematic mm-hmm. for most farmers and for all farmers, actually, yeah.
Well, and it seems in the big picture, they're not targeting getting rid of wildlife specifically through this, but just promoting monocrops. The corn soybean system just right. doesn't leave any room. You know, you were talking about fence row to fence row planting. I mean, that must be a big one right there.
Yeah, yeah. This idea of saving a little bit for the wildlife is not necessarily a part of the Farm Bill, which we would love to see that be a part of the Farm Bill. And we're working to change that. And there are lots of states that do have priorities that help farms, you know, implement regenerative, sustainable practices. And so we're trying to look at other ways of helping farmers fund some of these practices mm-hmm. other than the Farm Bill, because as we see with what's going on right now, it's not always reliable and it's not always the right source of funding.
I would think one big barrier would be, and I guess this is along the lines of maybe seeing certain wildlife species as villains or as a bad presence on the land. The other thing I think about is a few years ago, there was, and I don't know how much you folks are involved with this, but specifically out in fruit and vegetable growing areas, outbreaks of diseases on fruit and vegetable operations, and they were blaming, you shouldn't have wildlife habitat next to these places because you're attracting wildlife that's going to spread these diseases. I guess, first of all, how do you respond to those charges of vilifying the species? But yeah, how do we deal with something like that?
Wild Farm Alliance was involved in food safety issues because back in 2006, when the E. coli contamination happened in spinach, food buyers and farmers were ripping out habitat next to their fields because of the fear of, you know, wildlife contaminating their crops. And it was a lot of habitat was lost. And buyers were saying, you know, we're not going to purchase this because it's going to be contaminated or the risk is too high. And so when Wild Farm Alliance got involved, we really made sure that we worked with researchers and we were really promoting that actually when you have a diverse habitat with, you know, native habitat next to your crops, you're actually attracting the right set of species that are helping to keep your farm safe. And the risk of E. coli and other contaminants is less because you have a functioning, healthy ecosystem. And fortunately, the researchers also discovered the same thing and were able to document that when farms kept habitat near field edges, that those farms had less risk of having food safety issues. Mm-hmm. And that, yeah, it was safer when they had habitat. So we continually promote that actually, I mean, there are instances produces, of course, where, you know, you don't want raw produce happening, where, you know, under lines where birds are perching and maybe they are poop and the poop falls on your fresh vegetables. Of course, those are not what you want, but actually, you know, with simple changes and in your way of managing, having habitat is actually keeping your farm a lot safer, especially when it's native habitat and you're attracting a diverse set of species.
So I wanted to switch gears a little bit. You two represent this a little bit. Shelley, you've been with Wild Farm Alliance for quite a while, but Courtney, you're a fairly new staff member, and that represents maybe a little bit of a shift in that you're going to be doing more work in the Midwest, and you've started already. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we were able to get some funding in the last couple of years and hired myself. And we got money from the Blooming Prairie Foundation and built 100 nest boxes last fall and have put those all up on farms now, and we're going to start to monitor those. We just had our first field day with Kiwiden Farms down in Viola. We're getting ready to do a bunch of 3 different videos coming up here in June with farmers and pairing them with research related to how the birds on their farms are benefiting them. We also are getting ready to, this fall, we're going to be hosting a webinar series of 10 episodes that will have all the bird-related research for the Midwest, looking at how farmers can support beneficial birds and the perks that they can receive in return. And then we're also working on the National Conservation Innovation Grant that is looking at the beneficial bird habitat assessment tool, creating that for the Midwest, where we'll be able to look at the habitat on a farm, the plants that are there, look at what birds are already attracted, look at what pests the farmer is dealing with, and then recommend what additional plants to add to those farms to track the birds that will help manage those pests, which is really exciting work.
The farmers you're working with here, it's a different crops that they're producing, and or is it kind of all the same? You know, the same ideas, the same concepts, or how is it different? How is it the same?
I would say it's similar concepts and ideas. Maybe the specific crops are different. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're working with farmers in California right now, working on conservation plans that I'm working on, that are pistachio growers or avocado growers. And granted, you don't grow those crops in Minnesota, but the ideas of creating habitat, of planting hedgerows, of cover crops, adding compost, mulch, those kinds of ideas are uniform across the board. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I'm biased, but I think having you folks doing this work here in the Midwest is even more key than it is out West. Nothing against the West. They need it too. But they have more public lands. And here, if you're going to have an impact on wildlife populations and natural ecosystems, you're going to have to, in some way or other, interact with private landowners, specifically farmers, on a pretty large scale. So I think that's really exciting, that whole idea of working lands conservation. I think that's... We've done it with soil, we've done it with water quality, but it's really, I think the missing piece has been wildlife habitat.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, looking at the losses of insect population and bird in population in the last 50 years, it's just so important that we do everything that we can. And yeah, it's super exciting.
Across the country, the footprint of agriculture, you know, is 60% of our landscape. And so we can't rely just on protecting habitat and public lands. We need to be looking at spaces where it makes sense. And it makes a lot of sense to look at our agriculture regions, because it's not only there's no buildings, but it's also where the wild can benefit the farmer. And it is just a really natural place to look to improve habitat for wildlife. Part of what we're working on with our farmland flyways to measure where these nesting structures are is we have this map called the Farmland Flyway Trail. Oh. And it's we're asking farms to sign up and tell us where they have, how many nest boxes they have or nesting perches they have, and to sign up on the trail so that we can measure our success to getting to 1 million structures across the country. And what's really exciting is, you know, when we hired Courtney just, you know, a year and a half ago, we had, you know, a couple dots here in the Midwest. But now we're, I think there are more than 20 farms that have added themselves to the map. And it's really exciting. And we're just seeing it grow and grow. And you know, that's another way that we are using this map, not just to show, you know, how we're getting to a million boxes, but really it's about showing other farmers that, my neighbor is doing this, or lots of grape growers are doing this, or lots of vegetable farmers are adding these nest boxes. So maybe I could do this too. Maybe it's something that I should look into. And so it really is, I think, a cool way to build the movement.
Yeah, that's a great, because it's something, I suppose it's something that they can look at online and look at it and really does, like you said, create a community. It's like, I'm not the only one that maybe cares. I'm not the only crazy one that cares about that. One of the things that I think, and I realized this when I was doing the interviews for the podcasts at Key Wade and Farms, one of the things that really struck me, particularly talking to Joy Miller, was, yes, there's the pest benefits, there's the, you know, supporting the habitat that then kind of feeds into a healthier landscape in general, that kind of thing. But how much, I guess, delight farmers get from it makes farming maybe a little more pleasant and fun. I mean, you must run into that.
Yeah. I mean, I think even in my own experience of, like, just the fascination of nature, of hearing the bird song and then pulling out my Merlin app to record it and figure out what bird that is. Same thing with insects, like going out and finding this insect and having to take a picture and upload it to iNaturalist, and like using these tools that I didn't necessarily have 20 years ago when I started farming is so much fun. Like it just, it definitely just brings so much joy. This weekend I heard like an American yellow warbler, and I was like, and I heard it with my ear first, and I had to stop and be like, okay, where is it?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You know, it's the joy and the like, I mean, I'm sure it releases like the same kind of endorphins in your brain as like touching soil, right? Like it makes you happy. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you run into that with some of the farmers you talk to?
Yeah. Well, I think that farmers are environmentalists. They know their landscape and their farm intimately. And so when they can experience that they're supporting this wildlife that is providing, you know, a service to them, or maybe not a service, but just living on their farm, mm-hmm. I think that most farmers, if not all of them, are really excited about that. And because they care about their land, they're stewards, and they care what happens to that land. And they walk it and are on it every single day. So yeah, I think all the farmers I ever talk to are really delighted by all the wildlife that they see and they invite into their land.
Well, I mean, I think even just Joy, like where she was like seeing the eastern meadowlarks, and like I think farmers really look at biodiversity as an indicator of success. I know when I was farming, like it took a long time, but eventually like I had frogs. I was like, what? Like frogs? This is amazing and awesome. And it was just super exciting. So yeah, I think farmers, a lot of them see biodiversity as an indicator of success, and that's really important.
Ear to the Ground episodes 370 and 371 featured discussions about how regenerative farms can benefit bird habitat. For links to those episodes, and for more on how the wild and the domesticated can be blended on an agricultural landscape, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 372 at landstewardshipproject.org. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendell, Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.